Good evening, everybody, and welcome to the Native Plant Podcast. I'm your host, John McGee, coming to you from the getting wet and muddy headquarters of McGee Design in beautiful but wintry Middleburg, Virginia. And as always, I'm joined tonight by my co-host, my partner in crime, my brother in beer, the man with the magic voice, Mr. Mike Berkeley, Grow Wild Native Plant Nursery. Hey, Mike.
Hey, you know, John, I got to tell you, man, since you've been introducing me, I keep thinking every time you say that, the man with the magic voice, you know, of course, I want to come back and say, hey, John, hey. But I have, you know, I have had employees here. Fairview, Tennessee is, you know, out in the middle of, you know, it's west of Nashville, but it's out in the middle of the country. It is. And I have had employees that taught me a whole new language. I had a guy that, and this is leading up to one of my brews, by the way, my home brews. I had a guy that worked for me, and I told you about him, that he would say, I.
Yeah.
And so, but his big thing he said was all ale. So I made all ale, and I, you know, and like there's no W in there or H in there. It's E-L-L, all ale. And I made a brew one time called A-W-A-L-E, and it was an American ale with grits in it, corn grits in it. And it, you know, I think I may have shared that with you a few years ago. Took one to Colorway to let you try.
I hope so.
Hey, John. Hey, we got some things going on down here. I got to tell you, you had asked me about blooming. We're down here around Nashville. And this is crazy. There's these mustards, native mustards, that are blooming, and some of you guys out there, botanists that know about Lescarellas, it's like the harbinger of spring for us. And they, you know, they're typically calcifites, and they grow like they grow in these this limestone down here. But we've got some mustards. We have Lescarella stoenensis, which is the Stones River bladder pod. And these are bladder pods. They're cute little annuals, pop up, you know, middle of your lawns. And there's a Nashville mustard, a Stones River bladder pod. There's several different of those annual. So your question that you had asked me a while back, you know, things starting to pop up, and then we see in people's yards here in February and in the South, we start seeing the daffodils, the buttercups start coming up, the crocus. You know, some of those non-native bulbs coming up. But I thought it was pretty cool that, you know, you maybe stop and look and say, wow, yeah. Yeah, there's some native plants blooming already. And, of course, you know, we got the alders down by the creeks, the striped alder, the Ulna serrata blooming with its catskins. Yeah. Ooh, you know, get me going about catskins, John. I love catskins. I just love saying catskins. There's all kinds of things I could think about with cat skins. Do you have American filbert up there?
Oh,
you have American filbert?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Great.
Yeah. So is yours in the cat skin blooming stage?
You know, I haven't taken a look. I'll have to take a look. It should be.
I see.
Yeah. It's getting
close. We're talking February.
Yeah.
We're talking about getting up into the middle of February, and we're talking about blooming. What do we, you know, when we do some of these episodes in the middle of the spring bloom, oh, man.
We're going to be crazy. Yeah,
it's going to be crazy.
We'll be a little distracted during those shows.
About the native azaleas and all the wildflowers. Oh, that's going to be nuts.
Well, and, you know, the reason I was asking you about blooming was you're about 2 weeks ahead of me, which always surprises me because I just figure I'm, like, on the coast or something, I should be warmer than you guys should, but it's the opposite, I guess. You guys are, I guess you're further south than we are, right?
Well, you know, we're a zone 6B pushing 7.
Yeah, that's where we are.
Is that what you are? Yeah.
Yeah.
But I think it is. I think there is something. What happens in February in the Mid-South is that we get those warm days that pushes a few things. Now, our last frost date is still mid-April.
yeah.
you know, historically. But we start getting those warm, you know, fronts coming in from the south and kind of warms things up, pushing 70 degrees, sunny and 70. And, of course, things start flushing, you know. So, but it's kind of cool that you know, we Terry, the photographer down here, my wife, you know, she's an amazing photographer, and she can take all these photos, put it on Facebook, sending them up to you, and kind of let you know, here, it's just right around the corner, you know.
Yeah, it's great. I'm like, oh, this is going to be blooming next week. Awesome.
I get two springs. Well, John, we got a special show tonight. I'm excited about it.
Very special,
really.
Yes.
Yeah. Who is it?
I don't know. I thought you lined him up. Now tonight we've got Claudia Vasquez from Isle Natives, and Claudia, are you on the line? Just check here. He's reaching.
I'm here.
The mute button. There he is.
Oh, there he is. Hey, Claudia.
How you guys doing?
Doing
good.
Well.
Welcome to the show. Hey, man. This is
well,
great.
Well, thanks for having me here.
Our pleasure. Hey, Mike, little known fact about Claudio. He was once warned by the Secret Service not to use the term shoot the First Lady.
Oh, no. Oh, how? Why? I don't understand. what's the big deal about that?
I'll let Claudio fill you in.
Yeah.
Well, this goes back to my previous days as a commercial photographer, and I was based here in D.C., the nation's capital, and I did a lot of portraits, and portraits usually involve celebrities of some sort or another, and our local celebrities are politicians and lobbyists and power lawyers and the occasional actor and performer, but mainly politicians. And I was several years ago, I guess it was around 96, I was doing a portrait of Hillary Clinton when she was first lady. And it was a feature story and a cover story for the San Francisco Examiner magazine. And so I showed up at the White House and was going through the White House. I had full reign of the place to decide where to do the shoot. And I kept telling her social secretary that we could possibly shoot her here, or maybe shoot her outside, or maybe shoot her in her private quarters. And after a while, guy kind of looks at me and dead serious says, you know, you really shouldn't use those terms around here. And yeah, we were flanked the whole time by these guys, just armed to the teeth with no sense of humor. And you have a laser dot on your forehead the whole time. And it was just really funny. Just, yeah, please change your terminology around here.
Oh, so, no, that's great.
So there you go. Man.
So, oh, that's funny. So you're photography, huh? Interesting. Yeah.
Yep.
Wow.
And
how long ago was this, Claudio?
Well, I started in the mid-80s, and that lasted until, I don't know, 2000 and something, 2005, 2006, until I had a change of heart and decided to switch careers, for better or for worse, and get into the native plant racket.
Well, you know, I was going to ask you, here you are, you know, living in the middle of Washington, D.C., the nation's capital. You know, I don't live far from you. And, you know, we have a vibrant community around here. And all my friends from outside of this region find it amazing how many interested people in nature and native plants and that kind of thing there are here. How did you kind of find your way to a native plant business?
Well, it's a bit of a long story. Actually, one of your previous guests, Jesse, who was talking about children's programs, had some very interesting points. And I think all of us who get involved in the, or at least most of us who get involved in plants in general, have had an early exposure to plants. And I certainly did. I grew up in France in the countryside, very, very rural. I rented, or my parents rented, a semi-detached house, which was part of a farm. And the closest house to me was 2 kilometers away. And so I spent my childhood, early childhood, on farms. It was before smartphones and all these distractions that kids have these days. And when I didn't know what to do with myself, we didn't even have TV. I would just go out, walk in the woods, and I was surrounded by plants. So I always had this affinity for plants. And even before getting involved, my friends knew me as the plant guru. Little did they know how little I actually knew about plants, which is something that over the years now dealing with native plants, I've come to grips with, just because I've learned so much. It's just really an amazing field. But so I always had an affinity for plants. And when I bought my first house and started gardening, one thing about Washington, D.C. is that it's a very green city. And was looking for a sustainable way to garden, something that was environmentally correct. And it was really at the beginning of the popularization, I would say, of native plants. And one thing led to another, and then pretty much out of frustration and difficulty in finding information about native plants online. Again, it's important to remember that 8 years ago, it was the infancy of e-commerce, and there was just very little information about plants. You had a few websites. You had the USDA. You had the Wildflower Center, wildflowers.org. But those were – it was still very difficult to use that information and to make a good decision as to what you should plant where. Right. So on a whim – decided that, you know what, there really is some room for a website that could not only be informative, but could also help people decide what to plant where. And
oh, that's great.
I thought, you know, how hard could it be to build that? Well, yeah,
how hard could that be?
Yeah, exactly. But
I said the same thing about this podcast, Claudio.
Yeah. Oh man, you got to you know, guys, you just have to watch out for those whims. Those whims will grab you. Screw Look what you, whims man. Did to us. Oh man, whims.
No, sorry, but go ahead. Please continue.
Yeah. Well, so Claudio, basically, you there? Yeah, to build a website and that would fit what I wish I had been able to find when I started gardening seriously. So,
now, did you have experience building websites, or did you get some technical help from some friends, or how did that work? How did that end of things work for you?
That was actually the most difficult part of the process, because the whole company, I Sell Plants, is just two people, Amanda McLean and myself. And we had a long history of working together in photography. And so both our backgrounds were similar. And what we didn't have is any technical expertise on our team. And that was very, very difficult. Even today, web development is kind of like the Wild West out there. There's a lot of snake oil salesmen, yep. And it's just very hard to get to get a good team together. And we actually had two failed launches before we were actually able to launch the commercial side of our website. And it took us about 5 years to get there to be able to launch.
Yeah, yeah, it's amazing. I can remember the days of AOL Press. I don't know if you remember that program to build websites, but it was the simplest thing in the world, and anybody could use it. And now, you know, we just built our own, you know, page for this podcast on Squarespace, and that was pretty easy. But you know, having someone technically sound is essential.
And you guys, you know, you probably remember this. You know, back in the old days, so we would have to carry books of photographs. Yeah. You know, so, you know, and tell people, you know, we would tell people about these native plants that were, of course, were far from being mainstream plants. And we had to educate our clients. And the only way that we could educate our clients was with someone else's photography in a book that they just put out about native plants and landscaping. And we would have to carry, at least I know I did in my truck, I had, you know, a stack of these hard-bound books that I had to show. Okay, well, here is the native fringe tree. This is what the Virginia bluebells, you know, look at this. You know, to educate some of these plants that we now say, oh, God, wow, I mean, any information that you want, thank God for Google. You know, Google has just done this and done this, and we can have it on our phone. We can have it on our iPod. Our iPad, we can show everybody at the site, here's what I'm talking about. So the technology has been great for us in this business in the native plant world. And Claudio, I have to say, you know, photography, I am, gosh, I'm one of the weakest in that area. And unfortunately, I know people that, you know, like yourself and John and Terry that does the photography. And if it without that, I would be really in bad shape because I've got pretty photos. And you know how this is. You can show a photo of – well, and I'll use Mertensia virginica as an example, the Virginia bluebell. Is to show a close-up of that bloom sells it. When it's got a pink bud opening to a blue bloom, it sells it. You know, show people Indian pink when it's in bloom with a, you know, a yellow throat and the red on the outside in full bloom. And people go, wow, what is that? I got to have it. So the photography is one of our best tools right now.
I couldn't agree more. And actually when we started this, what we kept telling ourselves, is that, this website is going to be plant porn. And keeping in mind that the big catalogs who had started moving from mail catalogs to online catalogs hadn't really updated their approach to imagery. They had these tiny thumbnails that were of horrible quality, and they weren't taking advantage of the fact that real estate online is very different than real estate in print. There's no reason not to have several images of the same species when you're trying to sell it. So on our website, we make an effort and we try to capture the important stages of any given species. For example, if we're doing, if we're collecting data on a woody plant, we'd like to be able to show the plant in bloom and maybe the plant in fruit, or have close-ups of the fruit, show the plant with fall foliage if that's one of its ornamental values, and just really try to take advantage and have the best possible images, which is hard.
Oh, that's great.
I think our database is now up to around 800 species, and as much as we would love to travel the mid-Atlantic photographing plants at throughout the year, we just don't have time to do that. So we try to do as much as we can ourselves, and then we ask people to help. Some great people have given us access to their images, and we credit all of them on our website. And we find that it's important.
I know some of those great people, Mike, by the way.
Well, Claudio, I'm interested. I'm intrigued by your business name for one thing. And then how do people contact you for this? I mean, what tell me first, I guess, where did you get the name of your business? And then
how do you
work?
Yeah, I think we need to mention that because I'm not sure that we've mentioned it yet. But basically, I Sell Plants is we call it a marketplace for native plants. And what we do is that we combine the inventories of several growers on one website. A lot of growers are very specialized. Some growers would specialize in woodies, and others in perennials and forbs. Others do more spring ephemerals and shade plants. And so by combining everything, we're able to offer a variety and a range of species that you rarely find on one given website. So that's really the premise for, that's what's different about our business model. Mm. Sticking with the native theme, the way we came up with Izel was, I'm part Mexican, and my family had this quirk where they started naming all the kids in my generation with Nahuatl names, Nahuatl being the language of the Aztecs. And so my family has just the most bizarre names, and they're all deities or, you know, just weird stuff that you can't even pronounce. So to stick with that theme, I thought, what Nahuatl words would be good for this business? Because Nahuatl is arguably the oldest native American written language. And so we came up with Izel, which in Nahuatl means unique. And our logo is actually, our logo is a pictogram, also from Nahuatl. It's the pictogram for the word Xochitl, which means flower. So our logo and our name combined to make, to say unique flowers.
Oh, that's so cool. What a great story.
That's really cool.
Yeah. And so Claudio, you're talking about, you know, the 800 species that you're dealing with, and that's just mind boggling. And of course we've got a lot out there that we still haven't tapped into, and, you know, we're still looking for more of those natives because it's, you know, just in the eastern United States, it's so vast, these plant communities. But what, just off the top of your head, what would be the rarest plant that that's come across into your business that that either you've had to do find the plant or dealing with some of the nurseries? What's some of the rarest plants that you've worked
with?
Wow.
You're actually going to make me have to troll my own website to find that information.
Well, like I said, off the top of your head, is, I mean, do you deal with native azaleas?
Not yet. Actually, okay. Not yet. We have a few, but not the rare stuff. I would say that one unusual plant that we've had is the Troutvitteria caroliniensis, sorry for my pronunciation. Mm. And it's a rare plant from the it grows in the Appalachian, and it requires some and it has some separate populations on the West Coast, but it's the native population requires some very specific growing conditions.
Absolutely.
Usually rocky slopes with watery seeps. That's where it really loves to grow. But it actually adapts very well to garden conditions with a little bit of TLC. Mm-hmm. And so that's, for example, a species that we've had a lot of success.
Beautiful white flower. Beautiful white
Absolutely.
Flower and tassel rue, R-U-E, we call it. We've used it before in Middle Tennessee. Heat, sometimes the heat kind of gets to it. So I can understand that being, that's a big one. That's one of the dear ones for me. I love that plant, and I like to see it where it occurs up in Appalachia. And, of course, there's a lot of those plants that we wish we could use more, you know, down here in the mid-south getting to the heat. Oh, that's a good one. Yeah, good for you.
Yeah. But it's very tricky because we have some growers that actually – the growers we work with are really plantsmen. I mean, they just have the native bug. And what they like to do for fun is go out and collect seeds and find new species. And the trick is that – there's some beautiful things out there, but that are very obscure. And it's really hard to sell these things because, you know, we're kind of stuck between a rock and a hard place. You know, it takes a lot of effort to grow, to figure out how to propagate certain species. And then you'll grow them and nobody sells them, or rather nobody buys them. And so, yet it's great to be able to say that you have them. It's great to be able to educate people and kind of put that stuff out there. But everybody is also trying to run businesses, and the growers, they can't just solely be producing those species. So it's always a combination of stuff that's popular that people can look around and are starting to see more and more in gardens, either private or public, or in botanical collections. And, you know, they'll see stuff and say, okay, I want this. This is good. I can see what it's going to do. So we try to strike a balance, and every year we try to grow some stuff that's rare and try to promote it and see if it catches on. And then the next year we'll mothball those and try to promote some other stuff.
Well, absolutely. You know, you said the magic word, at least to a lot of the plant collectors that are out there buying in the natives. So you said rare. And sometimes it's the whole marketing is, if I say endangered species, if I say rare, there are gardeners out there that's got to have it. It's rare. I've got to have it. Will it work here in the Mid-South area? Well, sure, yeah. But it doesn't, you know, there's not that many occurrences of populations out in the wild. It doesn't mean that it's a weak plant. You know, Tennessee coneflower, Echinacea tennessinensis, is a perfect example. Mm-hmm. One of the toughest Echinaceas you can grow. But, you know, you say rare, and it's like, oh, man, I got it, you know. And is it hard to grow because it's rare? So it's all about marketing. John and I have talked about that several times, is that, you know, the magic buttons, marketing of these native plants. And sometimes it's just those keywords. You know, I'm glad you brought that to light, because that's a dilemma for a lot of growers. We got to keep bread on the table. So sure, we're going to grow a lot of those, you know, we're going to have echinaceas, coneflower, black-eyed Susans, you know, dogwoods, red buds here. Bed and butter plants. But then there are those others that, you know, comes from the passion side of the growers. You know, it's like, okay, I love, because you talked about a lot of these guys are very, you know, they love to go out and collect seed, and they're trying to find the next species. And you know, that's what's fun about this business, is that, sure, we gotta keep the bread on the table, but we are also very passionate about our natives, and we want to go and find that. And you never know when next plant that takes the gardening world by storm is, you know, it's going to be one of those natives. So that rare native.
Yeah.
Ooh, yeah.
No, and also
so under.
And also.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah, and uniqueness is something that really strikes probably the core of the gardening psyche. You know, we're all collectors in some way or another, And in a way, collecting is a bit of a status symbol. And unfortunately, that's why we have so many exotics that have come in. Because even when you go back to the early days, you go back to the founding gardeners as in the title of the book. Jefferson loved to collect plants. All these guys loved to collect plants. And it was a big deal to be able to have a plant from the other side of the world. It showed that you had the means to afford that. And yeah, it was a complete status symbol. And I think that's really part of the psyche. And I think part of the challenge for marketing native plants is to say that it's to be able to show that there are native plants that are very unique and that are very different. And if you're into collecting, if you want to have something that nobody else has, try some natives.
You know, rediscover some amazing our own stuff. Plants.
Rediscover the plants, right? That's been growing in our own backyard. for thousands of years.
I was guilty of that when I started gardening. I would go to a garden center and I would look for the weirdest looking plant, or I would focus on the one plant that I've never seen before. I didn't see my neighbors grow it. I haven't seen it anywhere, and that's what I would buy. But they were exotic.
Well, you know, Claudio, every time we have a guest on the show, I always like to ask that one question of why natives. Well, you've already answered that. And you said the word sustainable, something sustainable. And it seems like that's been a catchword working with side by side with native plants, indigenous species, is that there is a certain amount of sustainability with that as well. Good for you. That's great. I'm glad we found, you in this business. I can't think of anything but going up in your business, and because people are, they're having a hard time finding some of these plants, you're doing is, and I don't know, is it the word brokering? Am I using the right word, for what you're doing?
Sure. That's, even though brokering kind of implies a little bit more of a negotiation. And one thing that we've done with our website is made it very easy for people to order directly from the website and not have to worry about who is supplying what. And we've really tried to make something user-friendly. There are no hidden costs. Everything is up front. You don't need to go to the shopping cart to figure out what your shipping costs are going to be. We actually do free shipping on everything to make it a lot easier. But that said, behind the scenes, we also do a fair amount of brokering. Because we have such a large inventory, people will come to us when they're trying to work on restoration projects or mitigation projects. And they'll ask us, can you get this, or what can you recommend for this? And they're looking for large amounts of plants, the type of the amounts that you start negotiating. You're not going to.
Right.
And we do have some wholesale type products on our website. But still, there's a difference if you're going to buy 100, 200 plants, or if you're going to buy 3,000 or 10,000. So we are doing a lot more of that, even though that doesn't go through the front end of our website. So we actually do both. We have an online marketplace, and we actually do broker plants.
Oh, what a great business. Good for you. This is great.
Yeah, so it's fun. All that.
It keeps us out of trouble.
And Amanda's the greatest.
No.
We should also mention Amanda. She's the greatest. I'll let Claudio say a few words about her. She's just a wonderful person, friend of ours.
Oh, absolutely. The way our partnership worked or started with the plants, as I said, we used to work together in photography. And when photography started taking a turn and the business really slowed down for a while, and one day we were on the phone, Amanda lives on the other side of DC, and we were just asking ourselves, what are we going to do with our lives? And we had already been bouncing this idea around years before, and the idea just came up again. It's like, why don't we do this native plant website? And literally, and I... using the term correctly, literally overnight, we started working on it.
Wow.
The next day, Amanda started designing the website. We started pulling together a business plan, getting registering names, coming up the name, getting the business license, and it just started. And we worked very well together. We had a long history of working together before that, so we knew what we were getting into.
Yeah.
And I'm a little bit more of I tend to be out there, have ideas that just don't stop. And Amanda is much more pragmatic. She'll bring me back down to earth. And so we kind of have we pull each other and we push each other. So
that's good.
It works out very well.
Yeah.
Good compliment.
Yin and yang. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
I could not have done this without her. And I think she feels the same way. So it's really a partnership.
Yeah. Well,
so what's the future?
Yeah.
Claudio, what's the future? What's going on? What's next? I mean, what's?
Are you talking about the meaning of life, or
Claudio?
Yeah, the meaning of life. Yeah, yeah.
Well, I mean, with the business, what we'd like to do, and the original plan, and we're working there slowly, is to expand our inventory and our reach to other ecoregions. Right now, we're getting pretty comprehensive with species native to the Mid-Atlantic and the East Coast in general. We're starting to move south, bringing growers of species, more of southern ecotypes. But ultimately, we'd like to expand to the Midwest. There's a lot of opportunity with prairie species and a lot of interest in them. And we'd like to, the next big market really would be the Pacific Northwest. Great place for growing plants.
Oh, wow.
A lot of interest in native plants, lot of interesting species, and also the southern states, where arguably climate change. I don't want to get into a debate about that, but water is becoming.
I don't
a
know
big
what you're
concern.
Talking about, Claudio. What climate yeah. change? What do you mean?
I'll debate you. I'll debate you right now.
And so there's a lot of opportunity with plants that can be used, native plants that can be used in xeriscaping. So we'd like to be able to get into that market as well. So we have probably more plans than we can ever achieve in our lifetime. Yeah. But you know, lofty goals.
Yeah.
This is the part where Amanda reels me in. You know, I'll be like, let's move into the Southwest and the Northwest, and Amanda will be, all right, you know, let's take care of the Mid-Atlantic and get that done first. But yeah, you know, we have tons of plans.
Just,
and stuff that I'm not going to mention because we want to keep the stuff prioritary, you know, so.
Yeah, well, Claudio, what a great business. I mean, and timely. I mean, you started this at a great time. If you had started this 20, 30 years ago, you know, you'd be dead in its tracks. But, you know, perfect timing for this. I mean, the popularity of the natives and the landscaping and the gardeners are wanting more plants, native species,
and it's also great timing just because of our access to information now, and it works twofold. Yeah. We can provide more information, and also the public wants more information. Younger generations now, they don't buy anything without researching it first, and so it's working out. I think you're right. I think the timing is good. Yeah.
Well, cool. Well, with that, Claudio, you want to hang out for a little while and go through a couple of questions and then maybe have a beer with us later?
Actually, that sounds good. I was just going to say this conversation is making me thirsty. Yeah, it's about time to kind of wet the whistle or something like that.
Well, we've got a couple of questions here. I've got my bottle opener in hand, so we'll run through these quick.
Yeah, you drink that kind of stuff that requires a bottle opener.
That's right.
Oh, is there something else? Oh, I don't know.
I hadn't even thought about that.
I'll educate you on the other options later.
You know what, John? Because we use bottle openers, we're polluting the world with our bottle caps.
Oh man.
I'm not. I'm going to reuse mine. I'm making a necklace. Gosh, if I had saved every bottle cap.
Wow.
Oh no.
Wow.
I could have built a building of metal. Ooh.
Reduce, reuse, recycle, Mike. My new house.
Well, John, speaking of questions, and I, by the way, I, you know, we want to mention, we really appreciate the listening audience out there sending some questions in.
Sure do.
Nothing is forbidden. Ask the questions and push some buttons if you want to ask these questions. And John, that's when, you know, when we first started talking about having this Native Plant Podcast and getting it together, is that it's going to be a little different. We're going to cut up a little bit. Yeah, I mean, gosh, yeah, we'd pop a beer at the end of the show. But, you know, we know that some of the guests that we're going to have on for future episodes are going to stir up a little bit, out there. Feel free to send your remarks back either on our Facebook page. We have our website. What else we got, John?
Yeah, you can email us on the website, or you can send it via Facebook. I still haven't set up the Twitter account yet, but we'll have that eventually, too.
Yeah. But I want to go right to the first question is something I'm going to go ahead and jump in, John. This is from Frida. The subject was about grass cultivars. And, you know, one of our last episodes, we talked about winter inch plants. And you and I both talked about the grasses. And I mentioned something about some cultivars of some grasses. You mentioned the Panum Virgatum, the red switchgrass. And I said, you know, there's some great cultivars. And I think you and I listed about a half a dozen varieties of the red switchgrass, and Northwind being one of my favorites. And so she's got a question here because we mentioned the grass cultivars. It says, what I have read is that some cultivars are not as beneficial for attracting local flora and fauna. Please help me understand how the grass cultivars you recommend are suitable. And she sent that into the Native Plant Podcast. And Frida, I will tell you this, that is going to be a topic we're going to bring up when we start talking about cultivars, or nativars, they're calling them now.
Boom.
When we start talking about, I know, John, I know.
No, I said boom.
Yeah. So that's going to be a very controversial, because I myself believe in a lot of those native cultivars, and for reasons that we'll discuss later on. But I do believe that some of those native cultivars, like the echinaceas, some of those crazy hybrid echinaceas, are not anything more than eye candy. I don't see a butterfly bee. I don't see a native bee going to some of those flowers. So yes, but there are some varieties out there of perennials that still are great for pollinators, great for the butterflies. You can have a swamp milkweed that is blooming white, and it still feeds the monarch caterpillar compared to the pink straight species. Now, on grasses, it's crazy, but I don't know of any cultivar of a native grass, and I would appreciate any feedback from anyone out there, that does not feed the birds. I don't, you know, especially in the panicums, because one of the things that's happened with the native red switchgrass is that you're getting a larger inflorescence. So you're getting a huge flowering head on them, which produces more seed. And I have seen the goldfinch swinging over those in the fall, just eating away. And a lot of the grasses out there are now being introduced, especially from the government, strictly for forage. And so I agree with you that on some of the native cultivars, there is an issue, and we definitely need to approach and mention that. But in the grass cultivars, Frida, I don't know any that would not be beneficial for feeding the local flora, fauna. So hope that answers your question.
And I think you hit on a couple of good points there, Mike, and I think sooner rather than later, we're going to have a show called What is Native? And, you know, Mike and I'll just kind of sit and debate back and forth. Where do we draw that line? What is a native? And, you know, is a native or a native? And all those good things. But all that stuff is up for to debate. And I tell everybody to draw your own personal line wherever you want to draw it. When we design jobs, we will use cultivars. But I have clients who come to me every once in a while and say, nope, I want all native straight species plants.
And good. And that's good.
And that's great. And we'll do it.
That's good.
But I always also say that I would rather have a person plant a cultivar of a native than a cultivar of a Japanese holly. You know, I think it's,
and that's where the mainstream is.
Yeah,
you know, and we've come a long way, John. You know, I've both seen. Yeah, we've come a long way. You've seen it. There's more people asking for straight species, but it's still the minority of the gardening public out there.
And we're gardeners.
And you know, we're gardeners. We're gardeners first, and you know, we don't want to reintroduce the next invasive exotic. And we want to pull people away from some of those plants that they were grown up with for generations, you know, some of these mainstream shrubs and perennials that we now are calling invasive exotic plants. And we want to pull the people away from those. Well, the only way you're going to do that is to make a real pretty native plant. And sometimes you get a little outside the box and say, okay, well, here's a cultivar that has a double-headed bloom on it. It's crazy. Look, it blooms forever and ever and ever. And that's the only way, that's the marketing strategy, I think, for the native movement, plant movement right now, is to pull people away by showing a lot more glitter on the package. So, yeah,
that's
good topic. I'm excited.
Times, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
So we had one other question, which really wasn't a question. It was just kind of a statement about podcast we just want to read, and this is from Deb Tucker, and it's called Winter Gardens. Hey guys, first just wanted to say thanks for the podcast. Very cool. You're welcome. We're very happy to do it. You know, you had us hooked with children's native gardens, but gardening for winter interest? Now you're reading my mind. So I've always wanted to plant a Christmas garden, something curbside that would decorate itself naturally with native evergreens, berries, grasses, and other interesting deciduous trees and shrubs. Might not look quite as good as an inflatable Santa, but I'd love to give it a shot. I'd love to start a trend with winter planting and force the nurseries here in the Southeast to sell something at Christmas other than wreaths and battery-operated candles. anyway, we look forward to next week's party discussion and the next. So thanks so much, Deb. We really appreciate you know, the kind words, and that sounds like a good trend to set. Could do a Gaultheria procumbens garden, Mike.
As a Christmas tasty garden. Berries.
Yeah.
Yeah. Then eat them. There wouldn't be any berries left. I would eat them all. Tea berry gum.
Yeah. So, Mike, I know I told you that the dogs had found their way upstairs a couple of weeks ago, and that was a new change in our household, and I'm just here to update you that that has become a permanent situation. And Chewy couldn't be happier. Boy, he just is the happiest dog in the world that he gets to go upstairs at night now. So,
Oh, hilarious. No. Oh, it's all over now. That's
yeah.
it.
Yeah.
It's so done. So both dogs are upstairs?
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, it's over. That's it. Well, good. Good for Chewy. Tell him I said hi.
I will. How's Wesley?
Wesley's good. Today was burrito day for Wesley. And this is, I know I've told you this before. I shouldn't say too much about it. Somebody's going to write in and say, God, shouldn't be feeding your dogs this. But we go at the local restaurant where there is fajita specials. And I get carne, the, you know, beef, and Terry gets pollo, the chicken. She can't eat red meat. Our fajitas, and we'll pick out a certain amount of the meat from each one of our dishes and roll it up in a tortilla with meat only. And guess who gets it?
Oh,
yeah, Wesley. And so now he knows, and of course you know about, you know, Australian shepherds. They're brilliant when they know so many words. I think I read somewhere that they upwards around 400 words they can know.
Wow.
And so if I say burrito, oh, his ears perk up. And you know, ears on an Aussie perking up is very subtle.
Yeah.
But he licks his chops. So he gets a burrito of chicken and beef, two burritos, at the first of every week. So,
wow.
I know some of you out there that says, oh, we should only give dogs, no table scraps or anything. But you know, this is meat. It's wrapped in a tortilla, but this is meat. So they're getting, he's getting his burritos today. So, yeah.
Well, awesome. Awesome. Well, I think we've come to that special time. Claudio, are you still with us out there?
Is it beer time? Oh, man.
Still here.
Claudio?
I think it's beer time.
Claudio? Okay, how does Claudio, if Claudio doesn't have a bottle, should he do sound effects with his mouth or something? Is it gonna?
Do you have a bottle or a can or?
What are you gonna do?
Well, I kind of need to go get a can.
Oh.
Okay. Go get a can.
We'll do that, yeah. and then see if you guys can guess just by the sound of the can opening. What beer I'm drinking. That's a challenge. Or,
okay. All right. Okay. Yeah, that's a good challenge. I'll take that. Yeah. Well, John, while he's gonna get his beer, you wanna talk about what do you got this evening?
Oh, Mike. Oh, I've got a beer of all beers tonight. I am drinking something from Dogfish Head Brewery. And
good brewery.
It's a good brewery, and this is a chicory stout, Mike.
No. It's got chicory in it.
Got chicory in it. This is a beautiful, beautiful beer. I tell you, whoever made this beer did themselves right. So, how about you? What you got today?
Oh, I was in a kind of had a bitter mood earlier today. So I went and got an ESB, which means for you beer people out there, you probably know ESB means extra special bitter. Some people call it extra stout bitter because sometimes those bitters can bite back. You take a drink, it bites. You take a drink, it bites. And, so I got an extra, ESB. From Tennessee Brew Works, right in downtown Nashville, Tennessee. And this particular one is called Extra Easy. So it's a really nice, you know, we're very fortunate, especially, you know, you and I live in markets where there's craft breweries. And yeah. Middle Tennessee is just, the whole state of Tennessee is just going crazy. And I'm not sure, this is maybe a topic for later, but, you know, the beer laws on brewing must have gotten very lenient in the state of Tennessee. There's so many microbreweries going on, so many opening up. And, of course, our water down here, we got, you know, a lot of calcium, a lot of that sweet water that makes a good moonshine and good beer. So, but, yeah, it's Tennessee Brew Works Extra Easy ESB.
Wow, that sounds
Claudio, nice. Claudio, yep. You back? All right.
I'm back.
And, yeah. And they, all right, yeah, so let's pop, and then Claudia, let's pop our beers, and then Claudia, I'm going to try to guess from the sound of yours what it is, okay? So a count of three. Ready?
And if you can, one. Maybe your Australian dog can, by the sound of it.
Uh-oh.
How's
okay,
that?
Here we go. One, two, three.
Oh, wow. You guys are using a glass, eh?
It's what civilized people do, Claudia.
Oh, man. Well, John, yours sounded great tonight.
So delicious.
Good.
Mine sounded
I can hear the chicory in it.
So, on Claudio's, I'm going to go with Budweiser because that's what he's been talking about, you know, since we've been talking. So I'm just going to
wait a minute. Say that word again. I'm going to write this down. Can you spell that for me, please?
Well, no, I can't spell it for you. I'm sorry, but
well, if you just shorten it, what would you call it?
What's that?
B U D.
Bud. Bud.
Bud.
Bud. You have some good
Let's see. So you gave me a hint, Claudio. You said Australian Shepherd. Let's see. Oh, no. Foster's?
Ooh.
Yeah. Foster's. Yeah. That'll work.
Is that what it was?
That'll work.
No. Oh, no.
John was right on. He was right on the king of beers.
Yes.
Tingibus. Oh, got to do that.
Oh, no.
You know, I don't
know what,
like,
John.
You know, I used to like the kind of stuff that you guys drink, but I found that the flavor, after a while, starts interfering with my beer drinking. So, I tried to go light on the flavor.
I will never insult anybody about their beer taste, but I have to tell you, that's the first time that word's been used on the broadcast, on this show.
Yeah.
So say that word again. Would you say Bud Wiper?
Yeah, exactly. I usually just refer to it as the king of beers.
There you go.
I mean, you know, that really doesn't dust us.
Well, fellas,
I just want to tell you, up next week on the show, we have a huge show. Miriam Goldberg, author of Taming Wildflowers, is going to be on.
Excited about that.
Yeah.
Oh, John, this is big. Yeah, it's big. And, you know, and she's been doing that. She and her husband has had that business for ages and ages, back when it wasn't cool to grow wildflowers.
She is such a sweetie. No. I can't wait. I can't wait to have her on the show. So.
Great. Well, looks excited about it.
And if she pops a Budweiser, I may start thinking about rethinking doing the show.
Doesn't seem like she goes there.
We'll see. We'll see. Tune in next week to find out. Well, all righty, guys.
Well, guys,
thanks a bunch.
I enjoyed it. Yeah, I enjoyed it. Claudio, thanks again for being on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah.
Good luck in your business.
Check out Claudio's site.
Please do.
And
John?
Yeah.
Yeah. I guess we'll see you on the next one.
We'll see you on the flip side.
We'll see you.